Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
What happened to music that meant something?
The Who at the Kingdom or Kiss at the Coliseum. Where is the Misty Mountain Hop? Where is the Smoke on the Water? Where is the Iron Man of today?
This is not a test. This is rock and roll.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kotz. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, we're going to do a classic album dissection of one of the best albums of the 1980s, The Replacements' Let It Be.
Plus, we'll review the new disc from Steve Earle.
You are listening to Sound Opinions, and time now to welcome a new station.
Yes, Greg, Richmond Indie Radio. Richmond, Virginia's WRIR is adding Sound Opinions. We are thrilled that they have. As you know, whenever station picks us up and tortures its listeners by adding us to the schedule, we like to welcome them by playing a great rock band from their hometown. What have we got from Richmond?
The first band I thought of when I thought of Richmond was one of the first bands that I saw in the college rock, the indie rock scene of the 80s out of that area, and that was a band called House of Freaks. And I thought, you know, as a precursor of these two-person bands that are very much in favor these days.
They're all over the place now.
Bands like the Kills and the White Stripes. There's tons of bands like that. Back then, they were a real novelty. And they were not only a novelty, but they were a great band. Brian Harvey and Johnny Hot, two guys up on stage making this big noise. It was impressive. I mean, you were just going, how could two guys make all this sound? They wrote great songs, impressive live, made a string of really fine records. And there's a tragic element to this as well. I mean, Brian Harvey, one of the great musicians out of the Richmond area, died tragically a couple of years ago with his family.
Yeah.
And in a way, this is a little bit of a tribute that we're paying to this terrific band.
So a tribute to him and a welcome to WRIR.
Absolutely. Brian Harvey and Johnny Hot, House of Freaks, and Black Cat Bone on Sound Opinions.
Lonesome holler.
That's a little bit of Black Cat Bone by Richmond's House of Freaks.
You can keep what you want. I want none of it. They're just bad memories. I don't want.
That is a little bit of Radiohead, or at least Tom York, performing I Want None of This. Tom and Johnny Greenwood, the guitarist of Radiohead, stopped by Sound Opinions, Greg. It was in May of 06. Great show. One of the things we were talking to them about at that point was what were they going to do with their much-anticipated seventh album. Their record contract was done. Were they going to re-sign with a major label and go the traditional route? Or were they going to be ready to be the first band, not U2, not REM, no superstar act, first band to start this revolution and say, we don't really need a record company anymore. We're big enough that we can just distribute our music directly to the fans via the internet. Well, it's kind of a complicated story, but that's basically what Radiohead has decided to do. Starting October 10th, they are going to be offering their new album, In Rainbows, on their website with a model that is much like public radio. If you think there is worth in this new music, you can choose to pay whatever you can. 80 cents, $8, $80. You can take the music for free. They're taking a leap of faith and thinking that by offering this music as a download, people will support the band. They're going to put it out on an official release on CD next year. So it's not like it's never going to come out, but that's a long enough time, 3 months,
yeah.
That it's not like 2 weeks before we're going to leak the album and then it's going to be in stores. They're taking a leap of faith and believing that people are going to buy this record. It's also going to be available in a rather pricey $80 box set edition with vinyl, so that there's different levels of what you can buy. But basically, this music's going to be there for free. The question it's going to pose is, are people going to buy it or are people just going to take it?
Last year when we had Radiohead in the studio, Tom York was asked directly by you, was this going to be the shot heard around the world? And here's what he had to say.
I think it's a shame that the industry itself was so utterly dim-witted that they didn't sort of see this coming. But they were far too busy reselling the entire back catalogue of Neil Young and Rolling Stones and all this lot. And it's sort of now come back to haunt them because they ain't got anything else to flog again. As far as we're concerned, it's all about effort and energy and whether we really can be asked to start a revolution at this particular moment where actually the first priority is all the other stuff. If it was a natural part of the evolution of what was going on, you know, and if the energy from the music required that we did that, then we would do it. I think it's great to pick fights. I love picking fights. However, there has to be a natural reason to do it, not just one where you feel that this ought to happen.
Wow. Fascinating stuff, huh, Greg? They were clearly thinking long and hard about this. The Los Angeles Times yesterday ran an editorial. Only in Los Angeles would this happen. The major metropolitan daily newspaper in America devotes editorial space to Radiohead. Since you're doing this, share with us the results. Because the key thing here is going to be how many people actually buy the music and how many people take it for free.
Well, the coup would be if they get all these downloads and people pay whatever for them, the record eventually comes out officially the early part of next year and debuts at number one. That would be the coup.
I don't know if that's possible, though, because everybody who wants it's going to get it.
But consider that their previous three albums have all leaked well before release date onto the internet, were widely shared. This started really with Kid A in 2001. Yeah. People were talking about that album. There was a huge buzz on the internet. Debuts at number one. Now, what's interesting, Jim, I think about this and what's different about this is that it is truly revolutionary because Prince did this in the 90s when he broke free from Warner Brothers. He used his website basically as a record company. Buy my record directly from me. But he was sort of hamstrung by the fact that he had to actually deliver the physical record to everybody who ordered it.
And
he had trouble keeping up. It was a mess. Radiohead now has figured out 10 years later, we've got this great distribution system. It's called the internet. We don't have to send a physical anything to anyone. So it's amazing. They've got the distribution problem solved. And if they do solve it, if it does prove to be a success, I think what we here is the final nail in the coffin of the 20th century record industry.
Yeah, it's either the beginning or the end. I don't know which analogy we want to go to. I think you're completely wrong. I think it in one fell swoop makes the Billboard charts forever irrelevant again. If they sell a million records just online, physical product matters no more. It'll dwindle and then it'll be irrelevant.
Well, the key point there, though, is sell it. Are they going to be able to sell it?
Well, that's what we have to see.
Yeah.
And is it true Generation Y doesn't want to pay for music, or will they pay what they consider fair? Will they pay $8 or $10?
The other thing to note about this, Jim, is that Radiohead is not every band. Radiohead is perhaps the most respected brand name, to use a really noxious term.
A term they would hate.
In rock music. Fans love this band. They're incredibly loyal. They probably will want three versions of this record. They will go out and get the download. Yeah. They will buy the box set, and maybe they will buy the physical CD.
I'm very curious to see if the major labels hire people to download that music, take it for free, and subvert the notion that anybody would be paying Radiohead for its largesse.
You're assuming the major labels are smart, but they're not. He's a rebel and he'll never be any good. Phil Spector produced a song by the Crystals from 1962, which may well apply to Phil Spector today. Spector, who for the last 5 months has been on trial in Los Angeles for the murder of a woman 4 years ago at his mansion. The trial has ended in a hung jury. Apparently the jury could not decide whether he was guilty or not. 10 people on the jury apparently thought he was guilty. 2 people could not be convinced that he was. The trial was declared a mistrial, and apparently there will not be a new trial until at least next spring. So Phil Spector's future left dangling after this five-month trial. You know, Jim, it's interesting. We've seen all the courtroom shots of Spector. We've heard all the lurid details about this case. Spector, with each passing month, looks more and more to the general public like this freak guy living as a recluse in his mansion,
weirdo, yeah.
Waving guns around, pointing them at people, shooting people. I mean, there have been all these stories that have come out over the past decades of Spector loving his handguns, pointing them at people, waving them around in recording studios. Now he's been implicated in this shooting. This trial is just going to drag on and on. Lost in all of this, I think, has been the fact that this man was one of the architects of rock and roll music as we know it in the 60s. A lot of people tend to forget that now.
Well, yeah,
as a result of this trial.
It's kind of old news, the trial now, and I wonder, you know, what'll even happen at this point, whether anybody will even be interested as it goes to round two of the trial, attempt to try again. I think the tragedy here, Greg, is twofold. Number one, the history of his musical accomplishments has been forgotten. It's very easy to dismiss him as just this freak, like you said. Number two, you know, for how long his weird, eccentric behavior has been tolerated in the name of his genius.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, as we see Britney Spears melt down in full view of the world in public, it's just sad and tragic. You know, this is a very talented person. That doesn't mean they also don't have problems. And when we kind of like encourage them for their problems, everybody put up with Phil Spector's being on the edge of violence and having this fascination with guns and kidnapping the Ramones when they were making End of the Century, not letting them out of the studio. And, you know, Ronnie Spector, his wife, after he produced the Ronettes, that ended very badly, and she accused him of a lot of foul things. We've known this was a troubled man for a long time. It's been in full view of the world, and it's tolerated because he has this genius. Meanwhile, the musical accomplishments are forgotten in light of the things that he's done in his life.
Well, let's look briefly at what that genius was, because a lot of people, I think, have forgotten. First of all, Jim, I think this guy totally reinvented the game of production, being a producer in rock music. Prior to him, producers were sort of along the Sam Phillips model. They stuck up some microphones, they let the band perform live, they were a sounding board, they wanted to get the sound of that band in the room together. Spector took it to another level. He used the studio as his instrument. He was in control. In a way, he was the artist. He was bigger than the artist.
Right.
He assembled the artists. He orchestrated them, he arranged them, he produced them, he made them sound a certain way. If they didn't get it right, he made them play it again. It
was and again.
There
are tales of 60, 70 takes he would demand from someone like Tina Turner.
And he was a visionary. He understood what he was doing, and he had a widescreen vision of that. The whole idea, his quote, "the little symphonies for the kids." 3 minutes of this incredibly densely orchestrated pop music. The wall of sound.
People hear that again and again and again. It's one of those things that's accepted. It's a cliche. We wanted to show or illustrate as we can on the radio show what the wall of sound actually is.
First of all, he had the best musicians in Los Angeles. People may not appreciate the level of the musicianship on those records, but it was there. These were the very best musicians in the best music town in America at that time,
right,
Los Angeles.
Which means the world, right.
You know, Glenn Campbell, Hal Blaine, you know, Glenn Campbell, before he was Glenn Campbell, playing guitar on this record, one of 4 or 5 guitars.
Well, the idea was to duplicate 3 or 4 basses, 4 or 5 guitars, several grand pianos.
Yeah, Hal Blaine on drums, one of the great drummers of all time. Leon Russell, who was Leon Russell, one of the great piano players of all time. Before he became a solo artist, he was playing piano on these Phil Spector records. So he assembled these guys, put a singer in front of them, Ronnie Spector, Darlene Love, Tina Turner, great singers, and commanded, oversaw these incredibly ambitious real-time performances. There wasn't overdubbing in this era. Spector did not believe in overdubbing. He wanted a live performance. So it was take after take after take. And if you think about what Spector did, I don't think we have a Beatles Revolver. I don't think we have a Pet Sounds from the Beach Boys.
Sure.
These were all directly inspired by him. And I think today, when you think about producers like Dr. Dre and the Neptunes and Timbaland, these producers who have a sound and a vision in the studio, it's all a line directly back to Phil Spector, where the producer is the guy in charge and in a way is an artist in his own right.
Greg, let's hear an example of this. River Deep, Mountain High is a song that Spector thought was his finest moment. Did it with Ike and Tina Turner. Mainly, it's Tina's show.
Yeah.
And boy, she was a voice to match his vision for what this music had to be. This is an extraordinary production. It's as good as it gets. What is it, 3 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And it's symphonic in its scope and incredibly powerful. And again, all live, happening in the moment. Here's Phil Spector's production of River Deep, Mountain High.
I was a little girl, I had a rag doll, only doll I've ever owned. Now I love you just the way I love that rag doll, but only now my love has grown. And it gets
River Deep, Mountain High from Ike and Tina Turner, the classic Wall of Sound production by Phil Spector from 1966.
Coming up on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, we are going to do one of our periodic classic album dissections where we dig deep into a great record. This week, The Replacements, Let It Be.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. Time now for one of my favorite aspects of this show, when we dig deep into a classic album. And this week it's The Replacements' Let It Be from 1984. Jim, what we try to do when we do one of these album dissections is to look beyond the surface songs, the songs that everybody knows from a particular album, put it in context, discuss how it was made, why it was made, and why it was so important. This was a band of four scruffy guys from Minneapolis. Since then, one of them has died, Bob Stinson. The others have not gone on to fame and fortune. This was not a big rock superstar band, but this record, still 23 years later, holds up remarkably well.
One of those records
we were just listening to a few days ago,
Driving
around in the same town where these guys grew up.
Well, we were in Minneapolis, and we're riding around the lakes, and we're blasting this album. It was a great, great moment. We're in a Minneapolis frame of mind. We wanted to do this album. I think, though, certainly Revolver by the Beatles is accepted as a classic. We've done Sly Stone records. We've done albums that have sold a lot and been critical masterpieces. I think this album didn't sell, and a lot of critics didn't recognize how brilliant it was at the time, but it was a revolutionary record. It's one of the great lost classics of rock and roll history, period, and especially the 80s, a period when people like Paul Westerberg, the leader of the Replacements, the singer and songwriter, Bob Stinson, the scary, large, sort of violent, often drunk guitarist, the idiot savant, if you will, His younger brother, barely 15 or 16 when the band started, Tommy Stinson on bass, Chris Morris, the silent drummer, these four guys were rewriting the rule book.
This was the great shining moment of this band. They made other albums since then that had been more widely celebrated, but they really got put on the map with Let It Be. It was their fourth record. They'd made basically three records in Minneapolis that were fairly obscure. They were known to sort of a certain community of fanzine editors and indie music fans, but you could count those people on two hands in some cities in the United States. Let It Be came out, and suddenly there was this sense around the country that important and great things were happening in Minneapolis, and it wasn't just because of Prince.
Greg, to get this discussion rolling and for the historical perspective, we turn to our colleague, rock critic Jim Walsh, who covered them from the start of their career, was there at the first gig, often shared bills with his own band, with the Replacements. He's put out a fine oral history called The Replacements All Over But the Shouting, which is coming out next month. We recorded our conversation with Jim down at The Current in Minneapolis when we were there last week.
This is the first book about the Replacements, which I actually am very surprised about, Jim, but I can think of no one more qualified than Jim Walsh to write this book, because you were playing in bands alongside the Replacements. I believe you were at their first gig
in
Minneapolis. You were kind of with them every step of the way. You were an eyewitness to history, Jim.
it's sort of amazing when my editor said to me when we kind of finally got the galleys and were going over the last thing, we were sitting there and he goes, "You were sort of doomed to write this book." And it's true, because Paul and Chris and I went to Catholic grade school and high school in Minneapolis, and there's a very similar sort of water that you all drank from that. And then, we were all in bands.
Well, that's a good place to start. We want to dig deep, Jim, when we do these album dissections, into how the album was made and how it strikes us, what endures about it. But before we get to Let It Be and where the Replacements were when they made this record, bring us up to speed on who they were at that point. I mean, I remember the first time I saw the Replacements. I told you this story for the book. Mm-hmm. They came out. They were a maximum rock and roll underground punk hype. I saw them in Hoboken, New Jersey at Maxwell's. They came. They were awful. They were horrible. There were all these Mohawks there, expected a punk band because they'd been written up in maximum rock and roll. And they got this guy singing kind of Rolling Stone songs badly. And then the Replacements ended their set, but Paul wasn't done. So he invited the Mohawks, who had been taunting him and throwing beer at him all night, on stage. Paul went behind the drums and played Louie Louie for half an hour with these guys who couldn't play, who picked up the rest of the guy's instruments. You know, Bob was already getting drunker at the bar by that point. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's when I said, wow, now the whole set was lousy, but there's something special here.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went to see them because you went to see anybody on a Saturday night.
Right. And they were, you know, around that time they were doing these, they call them poop sets, and they would be jazz sets. They would play jazz, and it was fascinating. You know, what is this? They were decidedly not trendy. And if that was their reaction at that show, you know, they were an alternative to alternative to alternative to an alternative to punk.
So when they were getting a hipster buzz, they would react against it.
A hipster hardcore buzz. And certainly as Hootenanny was a reaction to Stink and anybody, you know, thinking they were a hardcore band.
It was so just, Hootenanny is their second album.
Hootenanny was their third record. I mean, it was Sorry Ma was their first record, first full-length album. Then Stink was the EP. And then Hootenanny came after that.
Right. Setting the context leading up to Let It Be, which was their fourth record, roughly 1980, 1983, 84, that period of time, you had the hardcore punk scene. The Black Flag, the Mohawks, hardcore skinheads. That was the big scene in the underground. You had New Wave kind of morphing over into the synth pop. You had Flock of Seagulls on the on the radio and Culture Club. And then you had these big mega mainstream bands. You know, it was the era of the blockbuster album, the Michael Jacksons, the Princes, the Bruce Springsteens.
And
then the Replacements really didn't fit with any of that stuff. Even, you know, their contemporaries in the Minnesota scene, Husker Du, you know, their first record, Landspeed record, you know, hardcore punk record. It was kind of understandable where they were coming from, whereas the Replacements, it seemed like,
right,
as you were saying, not really fitting in with any of these things.
But Husker Du was also stretching their whole thing with Zen Arcade that year. So they were paying attention too. They were not. They didn't. Husker Du did not want to be pigeonholed either.
Right. But they were sort of moving in the same direction as the Replacements were. But that was roughly their third or fourth record where they made that big statement record.
Right.
It was a great year for that underground rock because I remember Let It Be came out that year in '84. Zen Arcade by Husker Du came out that year, and we had also the Minutemen with Double Nickels on the Dime.
Three
really important statements of that whole underground music scene, the independent music scene at that time.
And in Minneapolis, it was Purple Rain, Let It Be, Zen Arcade.
Yeah.
You know, so it was...
Okay, so Jim, you interviewed everybody who was anybody and collected all the archival interviews from the time to tell this oral history in your book. Did the Replacements go into the studio, was it Blackberry Way? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did they go into the studio to make a statement record, or was this just the collection of songs that they had that would wind up being a phenomenal collection?
I think that, Hootenanny had been I tell a story in the preface about, you know, me kind of bitching at Paul one night and saying, you know, what are you guys doing, you knuckleheads? You know, this great band, and I had seen them for a couple of years, and they just like, they bored me silly. And I swore them off. You're like, I don't need to go see this anymore. It's just,
you were done with the Replacements.
They had not uncorked one of those just transcendent things for, it felt like, a year and a half. So Hootenanny was that, and it was around that time. And they probably were just getting bored with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they had toured with REM. Mm. And I think that it probably made them feel like a real band. And like, wow, this is something that is viable. Beyond that, I think it's just as an aesthetic thing. I think they just, you know, Paul's songwriting just ratcheted up.
Yeah. Why? You know, where did that come from? Because as
maturity,
we said, the first three records, they had little gems that said this could be a great band that could write great songs.
Right.
But then there was a lot of noise.
Tommy gets his tonsils out. Hi, Susie. You know what? I've been in the hospital.
Open wide, a doctor's here. Everything is fine. Got nothing to fear.
Let It Be is the exact opposite. There are bursts of noise. Tommy gets his tonsils out, right?
Right.
But song after song that is just so deep and moving, and like, where did this come from?
I guess that I would say that probably the REM tour, a lot of people were writing about him, and that affects an artist. You know, Peter Buck's calling you the greatest rock and roll band in America. Mm-hmm. You step up a little bit, I think.
But still the sense of humor. I mean, because Greg and I have interviewed Westerberg any number of times, refuses to take himself seriously. I mean, there are a lot of people, Jim, that we've all interviewed that are happy to be the new Dylan and that are being there. We could go well, see Ryan Adams, you know.
Well, let me tell you how I came up with that link, Jim.
Yeah, exactly.
It came to me in a...
The source of my brilliance stems from... You know, Westerberg seemed really, even more so than many people, freaked out when people would begin to talk about how deep Unsatisfied was, how deep 16 Blue was. And I wonder if Gary's got a... and the cover of Black Diamond by Kiss and Tommy Gets His Tonsils Out are the reaction to that. Because there are two sides of this guy. There's an absurdist guy.
Yeah, but he was terrified of Bob Stinson, too.
All right, are you not telling? I mean... Explain, Jim. Explain.
No, I think that is very much at the crux of why they were great. If you're in a band and you're the guy and all you've got is Yes Men, yes, 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 yes. Oh, great idea, great.
Yeah.
It's a horrible rock band. So it's like, you got Bob Stinson on your left, and Curtis Ace says this very well in the book, too. Kurt knew those guys before they were the Replacements. He knew he practiced in this band next to the Stinson's house.
There's a longtime Minneapolis rock scene stalwart.
Exactly, exactly. Kurt is like the Dean of Scream in Minneapolis. But he says that Bob would come to practice and watch those guys and just sneer.
So six foot something. About 250 pounds, right?
Yeah.
A presence who would sometimes, I remember memorable sets, one where he wrapped himself in cellophane to play at CBGB's, another where he was wearing like a baby diaper.
Mm-hmm. And tutus.
Yeah. It's very P-Funk when you think about it.
It was very P-Funk. I don't know if that's where he got it. And sort of scary. Because he was drunk and tottering and teetering. But also, you didn't know when he came up to you whether he was going to slug you or give you a hug.
Right. I think it terrified Paul more than amused him. And it's just, imagine.
So you're saying Paul didn't get feedback from the band, he was had to get it from outside.
Bob was like a hardcore critic on his left. And anyone who's ever been in a band knows what that dynamic is. It's very much like you bring a song to the band and they go, what is this? And then you got to come with Gary's got a I hate music or whatever, because it's you can hide behind that. When Let It Be started coming together, he was bringing demo stuff to Peter Jesperson, their manager and mentor and friend and
co-producer
label
of the
guy.
Album.
Right. Peter acted as a muse. I'm not saying Paul was writing for Peter, but that was a very sensitive outlet.
Jesperson, it sounded like, was the one voice that Paul could look to when he wanted to write these more sensitive songs that the other guys were just going, get this out of here.
Right.
It's a Brian Epstein kind of thing in a lot of ways.
Exactly.
You know, in later interviews, he would sort of fess up to the idea that he had to sort of summon up his courage to write The Unsatisfieds, you know, amidst
answering
the
machine.
You know, he had to placate those guys, and he had to sort of honor that side of the band for a long time.
Right.
And, you know, and remember, Jim, when he went solo, that was one of the reasons he justified it. Now I can write whatever I want. I don't have to please anyone but myself.
Right.
Now I can write these kinds of songs. And, of course, you know, Westerberg's never been as great as he was when he did have those guys as kind of the skeptics around him.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really beautiful moment in time for this band. The balance was almost perfect.
Maybe we're assuming Jim buys something that he doesn't. I mean, because for Greg and I, the reason we're doing the album dissection, we think it's their finest moment. I maintain that I can play for a 17-year-old hardcore fan or a sensitive 17-year-old singer-songwriter, Let It Be, and he or she is going to have their mind blown.
Absolutely.
Because it stands. I think it stands as their best album.
And I think that they, throughout their entire career, they were looking to that. They were not trendy. And I agree. I mean, and that's the thrill of putting this book together, is that, you know, this Christmas there's going to be, you know, some cool uncle or aunt or somebody is going to give some 16-year-old kid and go, here, this is why I'm so screwed up.
Gathering from the chronology that you've put together in All Over But the Shouting, I Will Dare seems like this kind of a starting point, the transition from Hootenanny, where you started to hear the songs that this band was capable of. And then I Will Dare, another leap up altogether, a song that everybody seems to agree that if that song had been released in 1992, would have been a top five worldwide single along the lines
have been
of
Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit. It just had,
I never thought of that.
The wrong timing. It was 8 years too soon, but it was that good of a song.
The reason we seize on I Will Dare is because it's a pop song.
Yeah.
And it shimmers coming out of any speaker, dashboard, or show you're at.
There's not a lot of production on the first three recordings The Replacements released, and suddenly there is. They're doing finger snaps, they're doing maracas, they're doing percussion. They're doing
Peter Buck's mandolin.
Peter Buck's mandolin. Chan Pauling comes in and plays keyboards. Mm-hmm. There's the answering machine on Answering Machine. Were they starting to have fun in the studio? I mean, you get the impression when you listen to The Replacements Stink and Sorry Ma Forgot to Take Out the Trash, these were records made in like 2 hours, and they wish they could have done it in 30 minutes.
Paul even said he likes producers who work fast, and that's very understandable with rock and roll especially. It's like, you know, you've written the song, you want to get it down as you have written it. You want that spirit encased or something. I think there was a sense, a real respect for the songs. And so I think that they just went, you know, we have to render these as imaginatively as the songs are written.
But I think what you're getting at, Jim Walsh, is the spontaneity in the moment for this band was all it was about. And
right.
It seemed like every stage show was that way, too. It was not thought about ahead of time. It was not thought about afterward. What do we feel like right now? And that's the way it's always seemed to be with that band. That was the charm of it.
That's absolutely right on. And it was not an intellectual experience.
Yeah.
It was this communal thing. And some nights it would just lay there because it just wasn't happening.
Yeah.
But the nights when all the forces came together and coagulated. I keep saying funnel cloud or something. It really felt like that. Like something's happening here, something's happening. And you wrote it and you knew it was, the clock was ticking. You knew this band was unlike anything else that came before or since, really.
We want to thank Jim Walsh, our friend and a colleague with The Replacements, All Over But the Shouting in Oral History. Jim, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, you guys. It was a pleasure.
We'll be back in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with more of our classic album dissection of The Replacements, Let It Be. Then we'll review the new record from Steve Earle, Washington Square Serenade.
Oh, darling, looking for a darling, and she's doing one. stick. He's wearing a skirt. Here comes Jane. You know she's sporting the chain. Same hair revolution. Same build evolution. Tomorrow who's gonna fuss? And they love each other so. Androgynous. Closer than you know. Love each other so.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. Greg, when we do these classic album dissections, we try to play a track that epitomizes the record, that stands as a timeless representation of a great overall work. Let It Be by The Replacements is a spectacular record from start to finish. This song, though, is just one of the best in rock history.
Absolutely, Jim. Unsatisfied, without a doubt, is the key track on Let It Be. Every time this song plays, it brings a little tear to the eye, a little chill up the spine.
Absolutely.
It's an emotional bloodletting that really was a revelation for the Replacements and Westerberg. I think part of the key to this song, Jim, was that the courage that Westerberg had to muster up to even do it, because the Replacements were a bunch of wisecracking guys who didn't appreciate sentimentality or any kind of emotion that wasn't juvenile in some ways.
Right, they were not an emo band.
And Paul Westerberg, however, was growing up, and the fact that he was able to wear his heart on his sleeve this way really said a lot about him as a songwriter and his growth as a songwriter. He makes this song not only with his lyrics and vocal, but the instrumentation, the 12-string guitar, the lap steel, things you didn't hear on punk records very much at that time, but he creates this amazing emotional atmosphere with the music he plays.
You know, it's a song about not getting none, you know?
Yeah.
The Rolling Stones in the 60s has Satisfaction. I think the indie rock 80s, the post-punk generation, had Unsatisfied. Who can't relate to that fact of being 20-something, having no significant relationship in your life, just one-night stands, if you're lucky? And on the bigger level, is this all there is in my life?
Right.
You know, earlier in that record, they sing about bacon and cigarettes. What a lousy dinner. That's what those guys were living on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's asking himself, isn't there more? I feel like I have more to say and more to do in life, but I can't get out of this town. With this song and with Let It Be, they would get out of this town. They would be known by some people, at least. I think they created a timeless classic that's up there with Satisfaction, and we just have to play it. It's Unsatisfied by the Replacements. man, that voice. That's the other thing, Greg. What a vocal performance. Unsatisfied by The Replacements. You know, Let It Be has only sold about 250,000 copies to this day.
It's a crime.
But it doesn't matter. You know, another guy from Minneapolis, St. Paul said, in American lives, there are no second acts. It wouldn't matter. The Replacements created a perfect album. It's worth seeking out. And people's lives will be better if they do.
In my mirror, pedal on the floor, bound for New York City, and it won't be bad no more, won't be bad no more, boss, won't see me around, goodbye guitar town.
That's the lead-off track of Steve Earle's new album. The album is called Washington Square Serenade, and the song is called Tennessee Blues. He is driving north out of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yep.
And heading into New York City with a redhead by his side who happens to be his latest wife, Allison Moore.
Number seven.
Oh.
7 times married.
So you got to love Steve Earle. He tells you exactly what you need to know right up front, the first chapter of his new novel. He's a very literary kind of guy.
Well, and Guitar Town was also the name of the album that really put him on the map. So he's talking also about bi to that musical style.
That's right. 21 years ago, Guitar Town put Steve Earle on the Nashville map. A lot of people thought this Texas singer-songwriter was going to reinvent and recharge country music in the mid-80s. It didn't happen. He was too radical for country, too country for rock. He has made a career out of sort of slipping between the cracks of genres. A little bit of folk. He's played some bluegrass. He's incorporated rock music. He's incorporated country music. Dozen solo records. And a very, very highly respected songwriter. The twist on this record, in addition to his move to New York City, which sort of sets the emotional landscape for this record, and his new relationship with his wife, is the relationship with his producer, John King, who was half of the Dust Brothers, very well known for their work on landmark albums like Paul's Boutique by the Beastie Boys and Beck's Odelay, the way they incorporate loops and electronic beats and samples. Earle is bringing a little bit of this into the palette here, so it's basically an electro-folk record that he's made here. Let's hear a little bit of the 12th studio record from Steve Earle. It's called Days Ain't Long Enough, a duet with his wife Allison Moore on Sound Opinions.
Another year is come and gone. Another circle around the sun. Another 1,000 tears have fallen. I don't ever count on the curse. I'm surrounded by your love. And days are never long. More seasons on parade show their colors, then they fade. But that won't happen to us, darling. We'll remember how it was, then begin again, because days are never long.
Days Are Never Long Enough, that's Steve Earle duetting with his wife, Allison Moore, on a track from Washington Square Serenade, his new album. Incredibly prolific, Steve is, Greg. As you've said, we've heard him do all sorts of things, including on the last two albums, Jerusalem in 2002 and The Revolution Starts Now in 2004. Absolutely searing, angry, acidic critiques of the state of the world,
mm-hmm.
against right-wing politics, against the wars that we're involved in, and actually offering understanding for why the Muslim world is upset at us, trying to question what's going on in the world. Now Steve's inside himself. a happy Steve Earle is a really unusual Steve Earle. This is a man who's fought off, famously, a heroin addiction, mm-hmm. has done time in prison. As I said, let me underscore this, married 7 times. And in all that time, I don't think I've ever heard him happy and content and singing a song like he just did with Alison Moore. So that's strange. The production is also strange, although I love it. Mm-hmm. This is a futuristic, looped, sampled production at times, but it's done in a back porch hootenanny way. So it's like the sampler is being powered by like a mule that's walking around the field or something. Wow, it's weird. It took me longer to get into this record than any by Steve, including his bluegrass foray, and I got 2 serious problems with it, and I'll tell you what those are. Satellite Radio is just a cheesy, hokum track. He happens to have a talk radio show on that medium, so it's like very self-referential. Yeah. And then also, there's an awful cover of Tom Waits. Now, I don't like Tom Waits to begin with. I don't want to hear Steve Earle covering Tom Waits way down in the hole. And what's more, it happens to be the theme song for an HBO series called The Wire that he's an actor on. So it's like, hey, Steve, man, all this cross-promotional synergy is tawdry and below you because you are famously an independent, free spirit maverick. And what's all of a sudden with all this, like, referencing yourself? That's okay. He's in love. I'll give him a pass. Overall, I really like the album. And if it's not what you expected first from Earle, there are rewards here. So it's a buy-it record for me.
Well, Jim, I have to say that Steve, ever since he put the Revolution Blues on a commercial a couple years ago, he licensed that. That was an odd one as well. This has all the makings of the midlife crisis record. I'm leaving my past behind. I'm moving to a new city with a new girl. I'm reinventing my sound. You know, some of it works, some of it doesn't. He's still a very fine songwriter. I miss some of the political broadsides of the recent records. There's still a lot of anger in this record, but it's sort of couched in these biblical metaphors. He's done a few of these songs where there's apocalypse now on the horizon. I met my mother and my father and my sister on the road to Jericho, and I know there's trouble ahead, and there's going to be tears shed.
Some kind of metaphor he's finding in Pale Mail, the hawk that was like boosted out by gentrification in New York City. I'm not quite sure what he's saying about that.
Right. So it's a little vaguer. The love songs are beautiful. The one we just played with Alison Moore, Days Aren't Long Enough, it's a beautiful song. He writes another wonderful song, obviously inspired by his new love, Sparkle and Shine. Yeah. Some of the prettiest music he's made.
My baby, sparkle and shine, sparkle and shine, sparkle and shine. My baby, sparkle and shine, never one knows she's fine.
So it's an interesting album for Steve Earle. I gotta say, I'm not sure I like the happy Steve as much as I like the angry Steve. So I'm gonna give it a burn it. It's not a full-on buy it. I think there's some problems with this record. I like the sonic experimentation. I think he's written some very fine songs here, and he's written some songs where he just seems to be phoning it in.
I was on the cusp, Greg. I went with a buy it. You went with a burn it. Fair enough. Greg, we have some thank yous to say. As always, Sound Opinions is produced by the ace team of Todd Bachman, Jason Saldana, and Robin Lynn, with Dave Mahler putting up with us as our intern, doing a fine job. We want to thank Cliff Bentley in Minneapolis and the folks at The Current for recording Jim Walsh with us, and Tori Malatia, our executive producer, our fearless leader. He was partying in Minneapolis while we were there. I saw him trying to get Garrison Keillor to do a duet on karaoke to Muskrat Love, and that's when I walked out of the party. I'm just telling you.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic, so now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Hey, Jim and Greg. This is Andrew from Aurora, Illinois. I just wanted to comment on your review of Eddie Vedder's record for the new movie, Into the Wild. I just wanted to take issue with your criticism about some of the lyrics from the soundtrack. It was my understanding that Sean Penn, the director, asked Vedder to bring the internal life of the main character alive through his music. And if you read the book, you realize he was a 21-year-old kid that was pretty wrapped up with a lot of the ideas he had discovered during college. And rather than characterize the album as Vedder's first solo record with some unfortunate lyrics, maybe we should remember that it's for a movie with a specific purpose to communicate this inner life of a main character. Anyway, that's it, guys. I love the show. Good work. Keep it up. Bye.
It's all right and all wrong. For me, it begins at the end of the road. We come and go.
Hey, this is Dana Blumrosen. I listen to you in Santa Cruz, California. I was so thrilled this week that you guys ended up reviewing Into the Wild, the Eddie Vedder album. Not because I actually would ever go out and buy an Eddie Vedder album, but because you brought back memories of my first year in college when I had that Indio album and that amazing song, Hard Sun, which I kind of wish you guys had played the original of because it's so great as well.
When I walk beside her, I am a better man. When I look to leave her, I always stagger back again.
Thanks for putting that back on my radar. You're absolutely right. I will definitely keep my eyes open for the re-release of the Indio album. You always keep me thinking and making connections about music, which is so much fun. Thanks again.
There's a big hard sun beating on the big people in the big hard world.
Hi, this is Diane from Rolling Meadows. I'm a long-time listener and member. Did I just hear you insult the entire baby boom generation over a Springsteen song?
Will the streetlights shine?
The gist of the conversation, I believe, was that we were all enamored and that our bubble was burst. And I think that probably the baby boom generation had been disillusioned from the very beginning. It was pretty much a cut to an entire generation. And I was offended by it.
Girls in the summer clothes, in the cool of the evening light. The girls in the summer clothes pass me by.
Hi, this is Stephen from Chicago. Boy, the comment on Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band really hit the mark, I think. I remember back in the 80s living in Germany at the height of the Bruce Springsteen Born to Run, but whatever the hell album that was. And kind of arriving and having all these Germans think, oh my God, this is the image of America, which is what Bruce Springsteen still sells today. I think it's true. He's selling the myth. He's not selling the great music. He's not selling the wet guitar, three chords, and the truth that used to be sold. So thanks for the comments, guys.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on sound opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with sound opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.